This episode of Dean Bakari's Meaningful Show is brought to you by Flashbooks, where you can get best-selling business and self-improvement book summaries that you can read or listen to in under 20 minutes. To learn more and get started for just a buck today, visit www.getflashnotes.com. Welcome to the Meaningful Show podcast, where every single week we work to bring you an inspiring insight, idea, or interview to help you live better, work better, and be better both in life and in business. Brought to you by MeaningfulHQ.com, we've got one very simple goal here on this show, and that is to help you do more of what matters and less of what doesn't. I'm your host, Dean Bakari, and if you're ready, then I'm ready. So let's get into it. And we are live, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dean Bakari, and my guest today is Kevin Kelly, who's the co-founder and senior maverick of Wired magazine and the author of an insanely popular piece of writing you've probably also heard of called 1,000 True Fans. He also co-founded a number of different projects, including the Rosetta Project, which is a working archive of every documented human language. And when he wants to take a breather from all that, you can find him serving on the board of the Long Now Foundation, which works towards fostering long-term responsibility as an antidote of sorts to the extremely short-term focus of most contemporary organizations. And finally, if all that weren't enough, he's also written a string of best-selling books, one of which he's here to talk with us about today. His new book is called The Inevitable, which is an absolutely fascinating read, where he essentially just breaks down the 12 technological forces that are going to be shaping the way that we live, our culture, our society, our way of life over the next 30 years. So I'm excited to dive into some of the big ideas that he shares in the book. With that, Kevin, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me here.
So before we dive in, you know, I'd love to kind of hear a little bit about a condensed version of sorts of your story, and because I know you've got an incredibly varied background.
My life story, you mean?
Sort of like what your, you know, how you got into what you do, or some of the hats that you wear right now, and then kind of what led you to writing the book.
Yeah, I was a science nerd in high school. I took all the science and math double up that a high school offered, and then really wanted to go to art school because I was mildly interested in photography. Wound up basically becoming a college dropout and going to Asia as a photographer, documenting the disappearing traditions and cultures of Asia, which were in a moment of flux from medieval times to modern times. I caught a really bad dose of optimism in Asia as I watched right before my eyes some of the poorest countries in the world become some of the richest countries as they bootstrapped their way up using technology, and I became interested in that story. I returned to the U.S. to write travel stories, and I got myself invited onto one of the very first experimental online networks in around 1981. At the New Jersey Institute of Technology in Rutgers, and there I saw a face of technology I had not seen before, which was very organic, and it convinced me that there was something important in this new communications technology that was changing the world. I was writing about it as if it was a new foreign country as a travel writer, and in 1984 I did a cover story for New Age magazine called The Network Nation. And I got involved in starting the Hackers Conference and the Well and Cyberthon Virtual Reality Jamboree and all this kind of stuff. And eventually wrote a book, took a sabbatical from editing magazines and wrote a book about decentralized systems. And I've been writing books since. Starting Wired, the kinds of things that I was interested in for a long time were suddenly at the very center of the culture, which was a very lucky break because I was talking and writing to people and it was all very fringy and no one thought it was very serious. And then the
now web, everybody cares.
Now it was at the absolute center and everybody had to hear about it. And that was a lucky break. And so I kind of continued to think about the future. I'm interested in the social consequences of it. Wired was really a magazine about the culture of technology rather than technology itself, which is sort of my interest. And so that's what I do. I try to look at and listen to the technology and ask what it's telling us it wants for the society. I temper that abstract stuff with a website that continues my whole Earth catalog experience of reviewing tools. So we have a cool tool website. I'm into documentary films, which I have a website reviewing that. I do a graphic novel about AIs and angels and robots. And my real deep love is for Asia. And I'm continuing to document the remaining traditions and cultures that are left before they completely disappear. That's me in a nutshell.
So you have a lot of free time on your hands, huh?
Yeah. the secret is no TV. Don't, give up TV and you can have a lot of your life back.
I love it. It sounds like you're keeping yourself busy doing things you love, which is awesome.
Yeah. Throughout my travels, I had no money, but a lot of time. And it's always much better to have more time than money if you're traveling. And when I came back, I lived my life as if I was a millionaire, even though I had no money, meaning not that I could spend things, but that I could
enjoy experiences.
Right. I could enjoy experiences and be interested in things as if I had all the money in the world.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. I'd actually like to touch on that a little bit later after we dive into some of the big ideas from your book, because I'm really curious about what you think about the way in which, like, millennials and, you know, young people today, and when I say young people, I mean 20s and 30s, are kind of, whether we're focusing on the right things or too much of the wrong things, and what we should be focusing on, what your thoughts are on that, because I know you've got a lot of experience. But before we dive into that, so a brief overview of what the book is about. So in the book, you talk about how each of these 12 forces of technology are based, they're based on different types of technology that are kind of on their way to becoming ubiquitous and changing our society. And, you know, I know we're not able to dive into the details of all 12 of these in depth. I'd love it if you could maybe kind of give us a brief overview of what each of them are.
Well, the general drift of the book, The Inevitable, is about the long-term trends that have been operating for a while and will continue to operate and increase in the next 20 to 30 years. Mm. And I've given them each one a verb, kind of a gathered into a verb, which is, or actually it's a gerund, it's kind of an ongoing motion. So they're like sharing, filtering, remixing, cognifying, interacting. And these are things that are inevitable in the sense that the biases towards these are baked into the technology itself. And the large term trend towards these increasing is set, but the actual specifics are completely unpredictable. So, you know, the telephone was inevitable, but the iPhone was not. That was
yeah.
Specific. And the internet was inevitable, but you know, the Mosaic or Netscape was not. And so, I'm talking about these larger term trends that have been at work and are going to continue to get work. And an example of one of those would have been this cognifying, which means to make smarter. So AI is going to increase. No matter what happens, there'll be more of it. And the specifics about who will be the winner in AI, what the AI will look like, how it will be regulated, these are not at all predictable or inevitable. And we have a lot of choice about them, and they make a huge difference. So let me just say that, that's the general drift. And so I'm looking at the kinds of things like an increase in the sharing that we're doing. So we're kind of aware of that, like in Facebook and Twitter, which is a type of sharing, but more importantly, like Uber, where you're sharing the cars of other people, or Airbnb, where you're sharing apartment space as if it was a hotel. And I'm suggesting that as disruptive as those have been, that we're just sort of at the beginning of figuring out how we share things. And one of the, not just the variety of things, but the scale of things. So where we're headed is using these new technologies to be able to collaborate or share, coordinate at the scale of billions of people in real time. That's never been possible before.
Yeah.
That's, Wikipedia is sort of the first example of what you can do like that with sharing the work of making an encyclopedia. But it's just, a kindergarten version of what we're going to be able to do in the next 20 to 30 years. And so,
Let me ask you real quick, have you ever seen, I know you mentioned you love documentaries and you have a site that reviews them. Have you seen, I believe it's called the Zeitgeist Project?
I did.
And where they profiled this guy named Jacques Fresco, who's a futurist from the Venus Project. Have you seen that?
That's not ringing a bell. The Zeitgeist one is, but not that part.
Yeah, I think they did. They had like three different. So there were three parts to the documentary. So it was like a series one, series two, and then
okay,
in the third
maybe you didn't see the third one.
Yeah, it was really, really interesting because they brought in this guy. He's a futurist named Jacques Fresco, and I couldn't help but think about him while I was reading your book, because a lot of the things that you say very similar to what he says and wanted to work towards, but I just don't think had the resources to kind of continue forward with that work. But it's called the Venus Project.
Okay.
And essentially, yeah, he's an engineer, and he basically has designed just different ways for society to kind of work and especially when you were talking about sharing.
Yeah.
He was talking a lot about how we should move away from possessing and more to borrowing and sharing things and things like that. And so I was just wondering whether you'd heard of it.
Yeah, no, I hadn't. In fact, that is one of the chapters is accessing. So I do think we're in the middle of this shift from owning things to accessing things. And oftentimes these days, the benefits of ownership are less than the benefits of accessing because of the responsibilities that ownership entails, backing up, storage, cleaning, maintaining, whatever. Whereas accessing, if you can get things in real time anywhere, which is often what the new technologies are offering, whether they're digital entities or whether you have very fast delivery services. If you have access to something anytime, anywhere you want it, that's almost as good as owning it. And one of the shifts that we're seeing is this movement from ownership to access. So I think he's right on. That is one of the shifts.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, going back to artificial intelligence, I'm curious, how far do you think we are from creating like a self-aware artificial intelligence system?
Okay, so
even dive into that, I'm so sorry to interject. Can I just ask the question that nobody wants to ask in a conversation like this when they're talking to somebody like you, which is what is artificial intelligence? Like how would you define it?
Yeah. So I don't know where to begin, but there's lots of things to say about it. In the popular way that people use artificial intelligence is basically that which we can't do yet. And as soon as we accomplish part of it, we don't call it AI. So right now, like your Siri or even Google, 50 years ago when AI was first named, it would be considered AI, but now we just say, well, that's just, you know, machine learning. So there is a definitional problem that you're kind of pointing to. Though the term that I like to use just to kind of skirt that problem is artificial smartness, because the word intelligence has a lot of heavy baggage.
Intelligence.
And the reason why it does is because we tend to think of intelligence as a single vector, as a single dimension. And you kind of have, you know, rats at one end and then chimps a little bit further along and then idiots, kind of mentally retarded people at one end, and then the kind of average person, and then genius like Einstein. And then maybe over there is this kind of, you know, the HAL AI. And that's completely wrong. 100% wrong, because it's not a single dimension. Our own intelligence is really a society, a spectrum, a smorgasbord, a suite of probably 100 different types of thinking and intelligences. And an animal would have its own suite, and it would have some of the same kinds of thinking intelligences that we have. In some cases, they'd be even superior to ours. But overall, it's a completely different mix. And so they might be smarter than us in spatial navigation, and in our calculators, smarter than us in our arithmetic. And so we're going to engineer artificial intelligences that also have a suite of different types of thinking, and that we'll engineer them to specialize in certain ways of thinking, because there's really not a whole lot of good reasons to try to make a human-like intelligence. The whole point of, like, the reason why we put an AI in the Google self-driving car is because it's not driving like a human. It's not being distracted. It's not, doesn't have this introspective conversation that, you know, causes it to be distracting. And so I think that we're, you know, going to do is really try and make 1,000 different new kinds of intelligence, and have them think differently. That's the value. So I don't think that thinking about it as human-like is actually very productive, because there's no commercial reason to do that. Now, consciousness is, you know, there's ways to have consciousness is not, again, binary. It's not a it's not like a digital thing where it's either there or not there. There's degrees of it. Your dog has a little bit of consciousness. A chimpanzee has some self-awareness. And so and there's more than one type. And so we will inject consciousness into some of the AI that we do to various degrees as it's useful, but oftentimes it won't even be useful. In fact, I think we may advertise certain AIs as being conscious free, meaning that you know, it's going to be really smart and not distracted by worrying about whether it should have majored in finance. And so I think that's why I like to use the word artificial smartness, because it is kind of sidesteps some of that sense of the baggage that intelligence has.
Got you. So you're not concerned that, like, you're not concerned. So when we hear people like Elon Musk, for instance, who are concerned about, you know, AI getting so smart that it begins to kind of construct something that we're unable to control. Like, I really wonder, I'd love to hear what you have to say about that. Or do you not think that that's something to be concerned about?
I think it's a possibility, but I think it's a very unlikely possibility. And it's certainly almost impossible in the next on the horizon that I'm talking about in the book, the next 20 to 30 years. Mm-hmm. In the very long term, I think that becomes, you know, more relevant. But I think there's many reasons why I also suspect that it's unlikely even in the long term. But though I we have to be careful, I think the concern about embedding our values into the AI, kind of parenting it, are legitimate and reasonable and necessary. So I think teaching it to be moral, teaching the AIs to be moral, to have ethical, is something we're already doing. Google has a team, and Stanford has a whole thing on trying to program ethics and these things, which I think is good and we need to do. So there is effort. So there is a certain sense in which the program, the camp, you know, the task of making sure that these are compatible with is a legitimate concern. I think the image of the robot overlords killing us all, kind of a Terminator thing, I think that's a cheap Hollywood trope.
Yeah,
that is easy to imagine because it's much easier to imagine how, you know, things fall apart than it is to see how all this is good. And I think it's a lack of imagination on our parts, and I include myself, because it's very, very, very difficult to right now. It's very, very difficult to make a scenario for the future that we all want to live in. So we've been kind of burned in the last 50 years, realizing that every new technology has a cost, has a downside, and that they're, you know, it's not, there's no free ride where you have even solar nuclear fusion would have downsides. It would be cheap energy, but there'd be some price that we'd have to pay. That's sort of, we understand that now. So we find it really hard to kind of make a plausible scenario of the future that we find attractive and that we personally would want to live in. And I think Hollywood especially finds this really hard to do. Because it's much easier to make a
scaring sales.
Sales is more dramatic. I mean, if you're writing a story, you want to have something bad happen. And so, I think right now some of the most influential determiners of our own future is, for better or worse, Hollywood science fiction. A lot of the people working on cool stuff now were inspired by Star Trek and Star Wars to make the, you know, tricorder, to make the holodeck, to, you know, invent the things that we were picturing. And I think right now we kind of owe it to ourselves to make a plausible scenario of the future for future generations.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of the future, talking about, I remember reading about how you're just discussing and going into the details of VR and how, you know, right now, even though it's not widely available in this moment, like we don't need goggles, for instance, to experience virtual reality, and how they're developing that, how they'll be able to overlay another dimension sort of over your eyes so that you can kind of just put yourself into that world. I was talking to my wife about this yesterday, and it was blowing my mind. Just after reading your book, and how, you know, people will be able to experience a whole new world without leaving, you know, where they are right now. But then also, in a way, I was thinking, you know, are they really going to, could somebody just get sucked into that to the point where, you know, they start to want to stay in that other dimension of virtual reality and start to kind of try to be someone else without ever leaving their own house? Do you understand what I'm kind of saying?
Yeah, it's a very common fear again. I think several things. One is the right now, you know, as of today in 2016, all the VR requires that I've seen requires, you know, glasses and or something, goggles that you put over your eyes. And the effect of it, though, is very, very convincing, very persuasive, very powerful. And you do feel as if you're in a different place. However, it's actually not very hard to determine that this, with any kind of introspection or any kind of study, you can determine whether or not you're in, you know, a VR world. It's not quite the Matrix yet, where you
we're not that deep into it.
and I suspect that the direction, the general direction of VR, is that, you know, we'll constantly be ticking off a box of how to make this more and more realistic. But each time we do that, we will be discovering two new boxes of what needs to be done, of how reality is has extra layers than VR. So there will always be more to do. I think it'll be endless. And if you want to be able to tell, you'll see the glitch in the Matrix, and you'll be able to tell. But the thing about it is that being sucked into it doesn't take much. You can read the accounts of people complaining about romance novels, and it sounds exactly like them complaining about, you know, getting sucked into VR, because people were completely upset and hysterical about you know, often young girls spending all their time in their room in these fantasy worlds and getting sucked in and never coming out, you know, because they were reading these novels. It was like Harry Potter. So there's several things to say about that. One is that, you know, youth is often obsessed with things like that, and that's certainly going to be something that we'll experience, but most people will outgrow it. And secondly, some people won't outgrow, but that's also completely normal. It's true for any for stuff that we have right now. And thirdly, I think generally we'll also learn over time how to, you know, mitigate it, and through education and technology, people will learn how to use this properly. And so I believe in techno literacy, that there's a type of literacy of understanding how this works, how screen fluency works, how the screens are different from books, and how technology in general works. And that is something that, just like we can't learn to read and write, it takes us 4 years to read and write. We can't learn it just by hanging around books. We can't learn calculus just by being near math. We actually have to study it deliberately. And I think some of this technology will require a techno literacy that we're actually trained in, or that we learn probably from others, co-teaching, but that it is something that is something that has to be taught. And so, and I think part of that would be, you know, the habits of balancing distractions, or being able to discern critical thinking and all that kind of stuff. So I don't think it's a big problem. I should say, I think it's a pretty practical problem that every new technology will have downsides. Every new technology will create new problems to be solved. But those problems will mostly be solved with other new technologies. And so I'm not saying that they won't have our costs. They will. It's not going to affect their general development. One of the points I make about the inevitable is that the kind of trends I'm talking about apply to the abuses of technology as well. Meaning that there'll be, you know, people will weaponize anything we invented. Someone will weaponize, but even as they weaponize them, they still will follow the same trends I'm talking about of cognifying and of remixing and of filtering. All these things will apply to criminals who are going to abuse these technologies and use them for harm. They also will be using sharing. They'll be using the flows, just like legitimate businesses. And so Even though there will be costs and harm caused, even the harm follows the same general trends.
Right. What would you say are some of the, like, the things, the trends, areas, industries, fields in the business world or careers that people don't know about yet, but will be big in the future over the next, you know, 5 years, next decade or so, that you'd advise somebody to kind of learn more about right now so they can capitalize on it once it becomes popular?
Right. I think the formula for next 10,000 startups in Silicon Valley is going to be take an X, take something, anything, and add AI to it, AI that you can actually purchase and buy. You can purchase AI from Google right now for 60 cents a 1,000 instances.
Really?
Yep. And you can buy, you'll be able to buy the best AI in the world to do whatever you want to do. So there are no VR experts in a relative sense. There are no AI experts, even though there's a lot of people working on AI. There really are no AI experts in terms of what will be coming. And so you out there have as much of a chance as anybody in the world to become the expert in AI or VR.
So you
can just start making stuff, start doing it. That's how you're going to become expert. You can't read about it. You can't go to school. You just have to do it. And you have as much a chance of doing it as anybody else.
So what does it mean to buy AI? For instance, from Google, you said, you know, you could buy AI from them.
Mm-hmm.
What does that entail?
What do you get? So the AI that Google is doing is right now perception. So what it can do is it can examine, it can look at photographs and tell you what's inside a photograph. And you can actually ask queries. You can say, you know, does this photograph, in this, they'll say, they'll look at the picture and say, that's a picture of a woman playing tennis. And then you can say, well, is a woman, what color is her shirt? And they'll say white. And they say, what color is her? You can kind of make queries. And so that might be useful to say someone who has a retail website and they have a lot of product stuff and customers want to be able to search through it and none of it's labeled or whatever. They want to interact with it. They want to query it. So
for instance, like you've got this app up and you're at a clothing store, like, I don't know, J. Crew,
yeah.
And you know, you're looking at it and you don't like this polo in blue. You'd rather have it in gray. So you say, you know, is this available in gray? And
right. Exactly. That could be something. Or you could have, I don't know, you could be a national park or something, and people could submit pictures of the plants they found, and you could use it to help them identify what it was.
Mm.
Or you
that
know,
sounds
maybe,
a lot more useful than the J. Crew app.
Well, I'm just step on the fly.
Right. Right.
You could have, you know, imagine. So the analogy I like to use is, like, you know, in the Industrial Revolution, the great innovation was synthetic power.
Right.
So you could suddenly, when you drive your car today, you have 250 horses. You've purchased 250 horses under the hood to do the work. 250 horses, and you know, for very little money, you have all that animal muscle power available to you. And now with the new Industrial Revolution, which is about cognifying things that we had electrified before, you have 250 brains at work. And so what could you do with 250 minds looking at, say, just pictures, 250 people who were at your disposal to look at things, look at videos, look and do whatever you wanted to do 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, always on. And you know, there's all kinds of things you can imagine them doing. That's what you would get for 60 cents, 1,000 instances. And
how many of these do you have? Because I'm sure you've got a bunch at this point.
How many what?
How much AI have you bought?
Well,
is that too deep?
No. So if you upload all your photos to Google, they'll give you it for free. So I use the Google AI. I have 150,000 images that I uploaded. And so I can say, show me all the pictures of my mother when she was young. There they are.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Give me all the pictures that I've taken of anyone wearing a pirate hat. Okay. And so the AI is doing that. It's actually looking at every single one of my pictures, and it knows what's in it. It has determined what's inside of the picture. And it can tell me instantly. So, and they're not charging you anything. That's for free because it's not commercial. It's just your own. You have to upload the photos to them. Mm. So, it's but the perception is actually not just images. They're doing speech as well. Mm-hmm. So you know, speech recognition, all those kinds of things are coming on very, very fast. You know, the kind of speech recognition, visual recognition, textual recognition. These are things that are available right now today. And it's not just Google. Google has the easy, cheap interface, but you can buy AI from Microsoft, the Azure as well. And I think IBM will be very, very soon behind them. So
that's awesome.
What could you do with it? That's the opportunity. Is take something, think about what you could do with perception AI, and you don't have to buy it. You don't have to make it. You just buy it, and then you resell it. It's kind of like an interface to the AI in some senses. You're doing something with 200, you know, 1,000 brains, always on. They're not human brains. It's artificial smartness. Mm. And it's going to get better every day. There's training sets are smaller. I mean, it's improving very fast.
Wow. That's fascinating. If you had to choose one important idea or piece of advice to pass down to future generations about just how to live, what would it be?
That's a pretty heavy question to future generations. You know, I need a little bit more constraints on that one.
Okay, how about this? If you had to choose one important idea or piece of advice to pass down to future generations about not necessarily how to live, but how to, with regard to doing meaningful work, what would that be?
I'm going to try and take your question and make it a little bit more concrete, because I think
sure.
it would be easier if I thought of a particular person.
Please,
that I'm
yeah.
talking to. So, let me imagine, you know, a 22-year-old listener of this podcast who is, you know, probably not an average person on the planet at this point. They're probably privileged in some ways. Mm-hmm. If I was to advise them how to find meaningful work, is that the question?
Bit
of advice. So this is a current, this is not like future, this is like a current person, right? Or are we talking about something?
Sure. Yeah. So if you were to advise somebody right now on doing meaningful work or finding meaningful work, what would you tell them?
Yeah. Okay. I think it's a little easier to answer. So, the common rendering of that is to follow your passions, which I don't think is actually useful.
Neither do I.
I think, there are several different other versions, which I think are more useful. One is, I think, Cal Newton's Newport's version of my own language is that you master something, become really good at something as a way to find what you're passionate about. And it doesn't kind of almost matter in the beginning what it is. You just want it to become really, really good at something, anything. And sometimes it may not even be something that you like, just something that you like enough that you can actually master it. So become the master of something and use that mastery to gradually move into something, to move through iterations towards things that give you more and more pleasure. And eventually you will come to that position where you master something that you love. Another version of this, I think, is more kind of Mike Rowe's version, which is you master something and but bring your passion to it.
Yeah.
You learned to love it, that it's sort of something that you can apply to what you're doing. So both of those suggest a very important concept, which is that in the beginning, you're not going to start with something that you're passionate about, because in fact, most people do not know what they're passionate about.
Yeah.
And finding what you're passionate about is sort of what your life is about. Your life is basically a journey to discover that. And there's no end point. I have people whom I respect who anybody in the world would say are incredibly successful. And they, you know, they're 78 years old and they're saying, I wonder what I should do when I grow up. They're saying, you know, they're still trying to figure it out. And that's actually a sign of their success is that they are still on that journey. And so it is a journey. It's not something you start off, it's something you aim towards. And so the meaningfulness is in the discipline of doing something over and over again and getting better at it all the time, you know, just deliberate practice of really trying to improve yourself, your work, the world. And the second aspect of that is that most people find helping others, being outward oriented, to give them meaning. So if you are doing something that is beyond yourself, that's where the meaning comes from. And generally you won't really be successful unless you can do that to some extent, unless you are adding value to others in some ways. And so there's practical and moral reasons to be oriented towards others in some way. But the more you do, generally the more meaning people find in what they're doing.
Absolutely. I love it. I love it. And are there any sort of, you think on such a wide range and you've got so many different things that you do and talk about and written about. I mean, what are some books that have influenced your way of thinking?
Yeah. Actually, I did a post at one time about the five books that most changed my behavior, which is, I mean, there's many ways to talk about this one is, but the one that I always sort of liked was which books changed my behavior the most. And they were Leaves of Grass, Gandhi's Autobiography, the Bible, the Whole Earth Catalog, and Childhood's End, which is science fiction by Arthur C. Clarke. Most of those I read, you know, in my early 20s, and they kind of set me along the path that I am. The Whole Earth Catalog in particular I read when I was just graduating from high school, and it told me and gave me permission to invent my life. Leaves of Grass kind of spurred me to travel as the best way to keep my mind flexible and as the ultimate education. My experiments, the Gandhi Autobiography was very influential me, influential on me in kind of my spiritual path, and really shifted, encouraged me to be radically honest. And the Childhood's End was the one that sort of got me really seriously thinking that humanity was a malleable entity, a process that, that we were inventing ourselves. And that was not just the, that you invented your own life, but that we as a species were inventing our life, our species. And that was kind of a meta idea that really has undergirded my kind of...
I feel like you kind of talked about that in this book.
I did. It's sort of present, and that was the beginning of that idea. It changed my behavior in a sense that that was part of my optimism.
Yeah. So as we kind of come to a close and wrap it up, I know we're coming down to the wire here. Just so people, if someone has to walk away with one big idea, like if you were to tell somebody, you know, this is the one thing you need to know from this book, mm-hmm. The Inevitable, mm-hmm. what would that be?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think one of the things that I'm trying to preach in this book is that we should embrace these technologies rather than resist or prohibit them, that by engaging with technology is the best way for us to steer it and manage it, and that we should welcome them and things that might seem scary at first, like AI, as we talked about, like VR, like tracking, because our lives are going to be tracked more and more. We're going to have total tracking of our lives, that we can't really stop these, but we can civilize them. We can make them, we can domesticate them and make them work, but we can't really stop them. Like, just like we couldn't stop the copying on the internet. It's just built into the way the technology works. And so, my kind of bigger message is that we should be embracing these, and through that embrace is the way that we can actually steer it. And we can, decide those particulars, which are not predictable and not inevitable. So my, parting advice would be to, yes, there was things to think about in AI, but no, we need to embrace them. They're going to produce more jobs. The robots are not going to kill us. They're going to liberate us, allow us to do jobs that we really want to do. Most of the jobs people are fighting about are jobs that humans should not be doing.
Yeah.
And VR is going to be the great social platform of all the social media, the most social of all. And we should be embracing these with wide open vigilance, but let's use them and maximize their benefits and prepare for them, rather than trying resist them or just worry ourselves to death.
Embrace the change, but try to steer it in a moral direction.
Yeah, and steering by use. It's by the using it is how we learn what it's useful for. Even the inventors of technology don't really know what it's useful for. This we can only determine that through use. And that's where I pay most of my attention. I'm really, really interested in how people use the technologies, actually use them, versus the way that people thought they were going to use them. And it's by paying attention to that we can actually see what it is that they want, where it is that they're biased to, how they lean. And it's that leaning that will tell us where they're going. And so technologies are not neutral in that sense. I believe that they have a leaning, a grain, a bias. And if we pay attention to that bias, we can anticipate and actually maximize more of their benefits and minimize more of their harms.
Fantastic. Moving on to the final question, which is the same exact question that I ask every single one of our guests here on the show. And that is, and I'm looking forward to hearing your answer on this one. What does it mean to you specifically, Kevin, to live a meaningful life?
What does it mean to live? I think meaning is something that we bring. We have to find or create, and by the way, in a very high dimensional place like reality, find and create are exactly the same processes. It's whether you create it or find it, it's really exactly the same. So we need to find or create meaning in our lives. That is something that we do, something that we are responsible for in a certain sense. And so I think, and it's also a process. So I think, you know, in a certain kind of recursive way, the way we find meaning, the meaning in our life comes from trying to make meaning in our life. It's the process of seeking that meaning that actually gives us meaning.
Beautiful. And real quick before we go, Kevin, if you could, please tell our listeners and audience how they could get in touch with you if they'd like to learn more and connect.
Yeah, I have a website, KK, my initials, .org, KK.org, where I generally post, you know, my newest books, my newest projects, links to interviews, even this podcast, we'll get a link there. I'm not active on Facebook. I occasionally post stuff. I'm a little bit more active on Twitter, where I'm actually tweeting this book right now and The Inevitable.
Yeah.
And I'm Kevin Tukelly there on Twitter. So that's
awesome.
Probably what you're going to find if you go to kk.org. You'll find anything I'm interested in right now these days.
Great, great. And I'll have all of this stuff plus the resources, everything that we discussed in this episode for you guys over in the show notes for this episode over at meaningfulhq.com or at getflashnotes.com. Again, the name of the book is The Inevitable. It's a fascinating book, understanding the 12 technological forces that will shape our future. And I believe, Kevin, please correct me if I'm wrong, but it comes out on June 7th.
That's right.
Awesome.
Yep, great. It's pretty brand new. And I think if you're kind of wondering where the digital technological world is headed, I think I do a pretty good job of outlining the social aspects of, you know, VR, AI, screening, future of advertising, the future of digital technology in general, sharing, and I think you'll enjoy it.
Awesome. Kevin, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it, and I know our audience does as well. Yo, it's Dean. Listen, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the podcast. If you found this episode inspiring, or if anything else you've heard on the show has helped you or made an impact on your life in any way, I'd really appreciate it if you showed me a little love with a quick review over on iTunes or on whichever podcast platform you tune into the show on. Every single review helps us reach and inspire more people to live like they give a damn. Listen, if you've got self-help questions of your own that you'd like me to answer live on the podcast, hit me up over at meaningfulhq.com. You can submit them over on the contact page, or you can just shoot your questions directly to me at questions@deanbakari.com.
Thanks again so much for subscribing, sharing, and tuning into the show. I've said it before, I'll say it again. It's because of you and tens of thousands of other listeners from around the world tuning in every single week, week after week, day after day, that we are able to continue creating content to help you crush it and make an impact in your life and at work. So thank you for being part of this and continuing to share the podcast with your friends, your family, and anyone else you think it could help. Until next time, this is Dean Bakari telling you to go out there every single day and live like you give a damn.